Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Amazon CEO Andy Jassy wants workers back in the office at least 3 times per week, but 16,000 Amazon employees really ain't trying to hear that. Google is changing directions when it comes to podcasting. The company has stopped adding playable links directly to search results and will soon add podcasts to YouTube Music. Screen time, like video games, may not have the adverse effects on children's development once thought. What is going on in the home in addition to screen time is an important indicator. And the State of Black Professionals in Tech report is out. It turns out that companies that are more diverse make more money. Got all this and more for you in episode 72 of The Tech John. From Columbus, Ohio, I'm your host, Rob Dunwood.
And coming out of Philly, it's your girl, Tech Life Steph.
And out of Atlanta, this is Terrence Gaines, a.k.a. Brother Tech, a.k.a. GDPR is starting to get on my nerves.
Just now, it's like it's been a long 4 minutes.
Starting to sink in. It's like, I'm tired of selecting don't track me or delete cookies or don't accept any cookies. Starting to get on my nerves now. I do it because, you know, safety and security and, you know, don't share my data and don't track me. But it's like, all right, there needs to be a website we can go to select our preferences. And then all the other websites on the earth and across the globe ping this website, find out what my preferences are per my IP address and apply those that way versus every single time.
That would make way too much sense.
Wishful thinking, bro. That'll never happen. you know, that's never going to happen. There's no benefit to anybody creating that because the people that want the information want you to be tired of clicking no all the time so that maybe on the 17th time you won't click no and they can get your stuff. So they ain't gonna make you do it every single time. So y'all, before we get to our tech stories, I want to let everybody know that you can support the Tech John by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/TechJohn. We have multiple tiers over there, and any one of them, which gets you access to our live stream, which we're recording right now, and our after party where you can hang out with us after we do the show. And there's even a couple tiers over there to get you ad free tiers, so you don't have to listen to ads in your podcatcher when you're listening to the show. So if you're interested in supporting the show, once again, head over to patreon.com/TheTechJohn. That is TheTechJawn, and support us there. So let's get into this first story. And this is kind of a little bit of a recap from last week. Last week, we talked about how Walmart is requiring employees to come back into the office. Well, this week, this is last week as well. It's just later in the week. There were 16,000 employees at Amazon are pushing back on RTO. This all stems from Amazon boss Andy Jassy telling staff in an internal company memo that they needed to be back in the office the majority of the time, adding it should be at least 3 days per week. His justification was when you're in person, people tend to be more engaged, observant, and attuned to what's happening in the meetings and the cultural clues being communicated. So, like other companies, he's a CEO, wants his folks coming back in. But within an hour of putting this out, there was 5,000 folks who was like, nah, son, this is not what we want. That actually happened on, I think it was 2 Fridays ago. And then by last Tuesday, they had a resource group that was called Remote Advocacy in Slack that had over 16,000 employees. The contents of the channel ranged from snap polls, 80% of which respondents said that if they do this, they're going to ultimately look for other jobs. And it ranged from that to just being furious with all kind of feedback. And they even launched a petition to try to keep this from happening. So just based off our conversation last week, I just wanted to come back and see what you guys' thoughts were on this, that we're, you know, this many of their employees are like, no, we do not want to go back into the office.
It's like, I kind of, there was some stuff in this article that I hadn't thought about before as far as making people come back. And the idea that, you know, some people actually moved based off of the fact that they could work from home. And so if they do have to come back now, they either have to have this long commute or move back into the city where it's more expensive and things like that. So there are definitely some considerations to trying to kind of unilaterally just be like, get y'all asses back up in here. But at the end of the day, I mean, the company is the company, they can do what they want.
I'm curious as to if these companies are really like, we really value the cooperative and the collaborative efforts of being back to work in person. So that's what we really want to get back to. Or is it like, are they like, all right, well, we know we're cutting costs. The economy is changing. There's this talk about recession. So why don't we use making y'all come back in the office as a guise for, we know some of y'all ain't gonna come. So
they weeding some folks out, yeah. Basically.
Weeding some folks out. People, this is our layoffs, making people do things that they have grown accustomed to, or like Stephanie said, what came on the auspice that this is going to be a remote job. And then for them to turn around and change your mind, is this like a guys for we land
it's a weed out process
by making them do something they don't want to do.
Shadow layoff or shadow reduction in force. I actually asked this question last week on Twitter and had some pretty good conversation around it, to where, and I actually stuck this in the rundown, but it didn't make our last cut. But Google, they've actually asked employees to come back in, but because we want to save money on office space, we want you to just double up. So we want you to find a partner and alternate days. They come in one day and use the cubicle. You come in the next day and use the same cubicle and work it out amongst yourselves, what kind of desk setup and all that kind of stuff you like. So I think that, you know, that too is a play to where we, you know, these companies that we've already done our reduction in force and we took those hits. We still need probably a few less people here. So let's just piss them off and let them leave on their own. We'll still give them a nice severance if they leave, but.
See, I didn't look at that Google story the same way. I'm just like, that to me, that's like, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't expect to demand to work remotely or only be in the office 2 days or whatever the case may be, but then get mad when the company decides to do what they need to do to maximize office space and run more efficient and lean by having people alternate sharing desks. Like you, well, that's, it sounds like they just trying to have their cake and eat it too. If you're clowning Google for that decision, I think it was the smart decision, actually, if people were not going to be there.
I personally think the article was misleading. I think they phrased it like that to get people mad, to get the clicks and get the views, because the way the title runs versus how they break it down. If you read the article, it's just like, ain't that what companies been doing? Hoteling? Yeah. That's been a thing.
And it makes perfect sense.
Makes perfect sense, you know.
So,
but I do believe that there may be some component to that, to where it's like, if we need fewer people, some folks ain't going to be down with this and they're going to exercise their right to leave without us having to lay them off. So, more so on the Amazon one, though, you got 16,000 people, 80% of which now people are saying that. Will they actually do it? That is a completely different question. But do you think that Amazon has to look at that? It's like, well, out of 16,000 folks, 80% of them are really, really upset about this. And even though it may not be the overwhelming majority of the folks who said they would leave, we know some of them are going to. Do we just, you know, suck it up and say that that's just what's going to happen? Or do we need to rethink this strategy?
I would no, they don't have to. We don't know the effects yet. What I mean by that is, let's just say, I don't know, 40% of these 16,000 people said, nah, I came on to Google because I was under the impression that this was going to be a remote job. You're making me come back in office. I'm out. Right. We won't know the effects of that. Well, the company won't know the effects of that. If that's the case in mass, it's got to be in mass. It can't be onesie twosie people. It's got to be a large number, a large enough statistic for Google to be like, hey, we don't like how this has turned out. Now we're struggling to find people and we can't hire anybody because everybody's remote and our competitors are hiring all these remote workers. The people have decided remote work, hybrid, 1 or 2 days, maybe at the most in the office is how we're moving forward. Once we see that, then Google will be like, all right, now we have to do something. Right now it's kind of like, well, you know, we should, you know, to make sure that we're not up against a wall when if in fact this is how people decide they want to work going forward.
Yeah, I would agree. And this story was Amazon more so than Google, but I agree with your sentiment. And then Stephanie, back to your point about Google, I did see that kind of that way as well, because I'm thinking it's like, you know what, if you like working a call center and they have multiple shifts, somebody is using the cubicle when, you know, you clog out and right. Somebody else is coming to clog in.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't necessarily have your own individual space. So I did go through some of the comments and some folks are saying, well, for folks who want to come in every day, they can have their own cubicle because they're there every day and they get their own space and they can keep whatever they want to keep in and don't have to worry about making sure that it's going to vibe with somebody else. This was, you know, to your point, this is for the folks who, well, if you only want to come in hybrid, we're not going to give you a permanent space. That doesn't make sense to do that. If you're only here 2 or 3 days a week, why would we have space for you for the days that you're not here when we could actually repurpose that space? So I do see that as that way as well. But I also do think that when they start implementing this, some folks are going to say, and anybody can say this for any job that they're in for any reason. If you have a choice, if you decide that I'm not rolling with, I don't like the way you guys are rolling, you can make your decision to move on. I just wonder if somebody is kind of counting that number. I'm certain that somebody's counting it, but is somebody like pre-counting? It's like, well, we think that so many people are going to leave before we go.
It's the same as actuaries, you know what I mean? That work for car companies. How many people can die? And if these brakes fail and we won't lose enough money to bankrupt us, they're doing the same type of trade-off, you know, analysis with every decision they make as vis-a-vis employees. So, you know, how many will leave? All right, we can live with that. So let's go ahead and do it.
Right.
Yep. Let's say it's going to take the people in mass to be like, nah, for them to be like, all right.
And ain't nobody going to do that because people still need to work. Like,
exactly.
So, ain't nobody leaving in mass. You know what I mean? Right. Like, a few folks will leave, but it ain't going to be 1,000 people walking out in one day. Like,
definitely not 80% of the 16,000.
No.
I do not see that. Some 8% maybe, but not 80. So, y'all, this next story.
Price of eggs these days. Ain't nobody going nowhere.
People talk a good game.
Exactly. Know. Until you really got to sit here and look at that, what that unemployment check going to look like. So, yeah,
that car note still comes when you decided you don't want to have to share a cubicle, right? Car note still do. Mortgage still do. So
every month.
People I know we're about to transition, but yeah, if you thought you was going to be remote 90% of the time and you come in the office one day and expect to have your own cubicle all to yourself untouched, that's silly. Come on. It's like, come on.
Right.
All right, y'all. So this next story, I know both of y'all are iPhone users. So you're like, I really don't care. But I did want to talk about this because I got some questions I want to ask at the end. So Google is changing direction when it comes to podcasting. They announced earlier this month that they would no longer place playable Google podcast links in search results. So let me explain what that is. Before February 13th, and actually going back into last year, if you would have did a search for the Tech John, the first thing that would have came up is the techjohn.com. The second thing that would have came up is actually the Google Podcast player links for the Tech John right there in your search results. That was number 2. I've seen it before. I wish I would have screen capped it before, but I've definitely seen it there at the number 2 ranking thing when you search for the Tech John. That is gone. So there were podcasters who noticed that it was disappearing going back as far as January. And then on February 13th, Google announced that they are getting rid of that, and it's gone. So you no longer have that player. The new thing though is that YouTube podcasting head Kai Chuck announced Thursday last week, the podcast will be added to YouTube Music. So like Spotify has podcasts built right into the Spotify app. You're now going to have YouTube Music where you're going to be able to search and actually listen to audio and video podcasts right from your YouTube video link. That is very different. One thing that we always know about Google is they kill stuff all the time. So I was kind of worried. It's like, is Google going to kill their default podcast player again? They used to have a thing called Google Play. Nobody knows about Google Play anymore because Google Play went away for Google Podcasts. And it seems like now maybe Google Podcasts is getting pushed to the side for YouTube Music. So my question is, do you think that the Google pushing podcasting into YouTube and into YouTube Music, if that's going to actually be a good thing for them, a good thing for everybody as far as podcast discoverability? Because one of the things that is terrible, unlike a YouTube video, you can't really, it's very difficult to search for podcasts. It's better than it was 5 years ago, but compared to searching for like YouTube videos or things just coming up organically in search, it is pretty abysmal. And I wonder if by Google, with all the search capability that they have, by moving this into YouTube, and YouTube is the second biggest search engine on the planet, will it be better for podcasters? Will it be better for discovery when they actually do move all this stuff into YouTube Music?
Is there a free version of YouTube Music?
And that's just what I was going to say. Only if there's a free version, if they're trying to force people.
Yeah, because that's what it sounds like. They're just trying to force people to pay for YouTube Music. But if they're, that's the only reason I can think that they would do something like that, make that kind of move of, say, trying to, force people onto YouTube
Music. So YouTube Music will allow free ad-supported background listening to podcasts and offer enhanced library tools. So like the paid version, so one of the things that YouTube Music can do, if you've ever played with YouTube Music, it's better in a lot of ways than like the free version of Spotify, because you can actually listen to whatever song you want to listen to. The issue is that you can't do it in the background on your phone. You literally have to have your screen on and be on the YouTube Music app in order for it to play. So you lose all the benefit of actually having it on your phone in the first place if you're trying to do something else. If you just have your phone sitting there playing through a speaker, I guess that would be fine. But if you're trying to do anything else with your phone, as soon as you switch off of the screen, it goes away. So what they're
saying, screen time's out.
Yeah. Or that. So what they're saying is that we're going to set this up so that you can actually play YouTube Music for podcasts in the background on your device, but it will be ad supported. So that brings the question up. Well, like with YouTube, will there be a ad revenue share that goes to the actual podcaster?
I would assume so. But if it's a part of YouTube, I'm pretty sure there's some sort of barrier, like with YouTube, in order to monetize, you got to have X amount of subscribers or whatever the barrier is. If it's going to be part of that, again, you would assume that they're going to, especially if they're playing ads. I take it back, because if they're modeling it after Pandora or Spotify. Does Spotify offer ads? Because I'm not a Spotify user. Can you?
There's a
to
free
music?
Version.
Do they put ads on that? On the free version of Spotify?
I think you can also listen to podcasts on the free version of Spotify as well. But I don't know. I've got the paid version, so I don't know. My experience is that I don't hear ads from Spotify and podcasts that I'm listening to, but I actually have a Spotify subscription.
I'm pretty sure Spotify, because I've had the free version of Spotify in the past. It's been a long time. I don't really use, I use Apple Music now. But I feel like when I was using it, there was, I don't remember it being as obnoxious as Pandora, because Pandora is like every third song or whatever.
Right, right.
But I know there were like a lot of functionality and feature restrictions. Like you couldn't skip any songs. Right, you couldn't shuffle. You couldn't. You couldn't do all of that kind of thing. But I don't. If they, I'm pretty sure they do. But if they do, they definitely were not as obtrusive as a Pandora.
So, I, in uploading videos to YouTube for the Tech John, I saw that there is a podcast option. And it took me 20 minutes to figure out how to utilize this, because this goes along with this story. There is an option when you upload video is you can upload a podcast. Now, they need to iron some things out, because I got mad confused about, all right, am I uploading a video and in YouTube podcast or YouTube music, the podcast option, is the video going to be playing? And then, like Rob said, it'll give you the ability to lock your screen. It'll give you the ability to listen to some, watch something, watch Twitter, you know, scroll your feed or whatever while the YouTube podcast is playing in the background. And if that's the case, shouldn't I be uploading audio to YouTube? Or are they taking the video and breaking out the audio for YouTube podcasts? Or is it just a podcast playlist? And if you want to watch it, fine. And if you don't, you don't. So all that to say, I tried to upload some of our previous shows as a podcast. I'm not even sure I did it right because there was no, okay, well, if you upload the video, this will happen. Or upload the video, we'll separate out the audio. Or in order to make a YouTube podcast, you need to upload an audio file only. So I tried some stuff. So we'll see if it works. But
some random stuff out there on YouTube at this point.
I even tried to Google it, and they didn't even have anything in Google as to how you create or upload or curate a podcast from the audio and or video content. So this is very, very new, and they do need to figure that out, specifically the revenue split. A split, because that's the whole point of uploading to, well, not, you want to get viewers and you want to get subscribers and you want to get followers, but you also want to get paid. So one of the reasons why you upload to YouTube is once you hit that threshold, you know, they start to monetize your content, then you can get a little split. So hopefully this is the same thing for a podcast as well.
Yeah. I wonder how that's going to work, because if you already have ads in your content, are they just doing like pre-roll and post-roll ads? They're not actually injecting in the middle of your show. You know, we don't know. We have to wait and see all this stuff, you know, come out. So putting your podcast on YouTube has been a thing for a minute.
It's just been a video.
It's just been the video. But here was one of the things, you know, as I started to read through this, some of the things that were interesting about what YouTube Music is going to do is that let's say that you have a video first podcast. You know, we have video, but I think that we would still consider ourselves audio first with video. But there are some podcasts out there that literally are video first, and they are meant to be watched. Some of the things that you're going to be able to do with YouTube Music is that you can start watching in one place. Let's say you're watching on your Chromecast, and then you can move over to your tablet, and then you can move over to your phone, and it'll keep your spot. It'll also remember that, well, you were watching the video here, but you only want to get the audio there. It's going to actually do that kind of syncing as well, which I think is kind of interesting, because some of these podcasts are really long. Like, you know, we kind of say, man, that was a long show when we go 70 minutes, but there's podcasts out there, they're 2.5-3 hours long, and you're just not sitting down in one place to watch that. So you might pick it up while you're in the car. You might pick it up while you're working out. And if YouTube Music is going to be able to make it easy to go back and forth between those modalities where you were watching and now you're listening, and then you were listening and now you're watching, but it picks right up where you left off, I think that actually is kind of interesting. The most important thing, though, is what is that ad revenue split going to look like? Are they even going to offer it? And then two, will this actually help with podcast discovery? I think that it is almost laughable that Google is just now really thinking about podcast discovery. They're the biggest search engine and the second biggest search engine on the planet. Podcasts have been popular for a while. Clearly somebody at Google has to know that it is extremely difficult to search for podcasts. It seems like they would have tried to crack this nut a while ago. So, you know, I guess it's better late than never.
I was thinking that too, as you were kind of going through it, like, why are we just now talking about this? Like, it definitely seems like this is something that should have happened a long time ago, but I don't know. I guess Google had higher priority things to do.
They'd be trying. Half-ass trying.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it goes back to just Google's incentive models that they have for development, to where you are incentivized to launch something, not necessarily to make the something better over time. That is drastically different than...
Get promoted and you kick the can down the road.
You literally kick it down the road. You move on to the next thing. So all of that knowledge on the thing you were working on that got you the promotion just kind of goes with you on to the next thing. So, Google definitely needs to get better at that. But this is one that I'm truly interested in, because number one is, like, they said ads. And when they said ads, that means revenue. If they say revenue, it's like, okay, does it all go to Google, or is there a revenue split? We are all interested in that, because, you know, we're already putting our stuff there. So that it would make sense for us. But also, will the discovery get a little bit better? So, Stephanie, this is one you stuck in here. This is a really really interesting article from the Wall Street Journal that came out about screen time and its effect on kids. In one study, affluent kids have a better outcome than poor kids. But this may have been more about family dynamics than actually about the amount of time that children are physically in front of a screen. Mm-hmm. So what were your thoughts on this article?
Yeah, I put this in here because I get this question all the time. I talk to parents, you know, about their kids' social media and screen time, you know, regularly. And they're always like, well, what's too much? And what should we be doing? And how do I keep them from blah, 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 blah? And I'm always trying to drill home the point that your involvement is the most important thing. And they never seem to want to listen and understand. They seem to want a solution or a quick, easy sort of silver bullet way to say, do this one thing or change this one setting or, you know, whatever. And it's like,
okay. So I was not confused. I was hoping that you wasn't saying that the parents was looking for a reason as to how they can, or the best way as to how they can dish off the responsibility of interacting with their kids.
I mean, it kind of sounds to hear some parents talk about it. It kind of sounds like it. Yeah. And, you know, when you think about that, you know, as I was thinking about that and reading this article, the article pretty much makes the correlation towards lower income children having more negative types of interaction and more negative types of screen time. And it was interesting because the article didn't really necessarily demonize screen time at all, really. I mean, unless it's for like very, very young children, like don't give a child under the age of one a screen, because right. You do actually stunt their brain development at that age. But for kids 4 or 5 and older, it's not necessarily the amount of screen time, but it's what you're doing when you're on that screen. And so the idea that, you know, lower income students have worse outcomes as it relates to that, because I would imagine because they have less involved parents, because the parents are probably working more hours, right, and doing more things and things like that. And maybe
or can't
not
afford these activities, because good grief.
Yeah.
Man,
yeah,
I got kids right now, activities, and they in my pockets. So I can imagine not having the type of resources that I have. And still trying to raise kids, doing it the best you can. And it's like, all right, well, I need something for you to do. I can't afford you in this camp and that camp and this thing and that thing. Here.
And then the neighborhoods are such that kids can't go outside and play anymore because it's not safe. And it's just this vicious circle that this thing called the internet that was supposed to be this, you know, democratizing force in our society and things like that is really kind of backfiring when it comes to, you know, people with lower incomes, because they're just consuming a lot of it. But it feels like it should be an easy fix because everybody gets the same internet. So, you know, how can we coax, you know, our young, and I don't want to just, you know, make the blanket statement that only Black people are low income, but, you know, I care about Black people with low income. So like, how do we convince, you know, our people to help their children make better choices, or how do we help the children make better choices as it relates to the type of content they consume online?
So
I will say, go ahead,
Ryan. I was going to say one of the things that I was picking up in this article was that it was, they kind of made the correlation to video games. So we are all of the age that when we were kids and they were coming up, they were talking about how playing video games was rotting our brains and this and that and the other. And pretty much every study recently, or not even recently, in the last 30 years have come out and said, no, that's not really true. It's about what you do in addition to the video games. It's about the interactions that you're having outside of just playing those games. And I think that that was kind of the thing here. It did say for very young children, Stephanie, you do not want them on screens pretty much at all, unless it's like they're talking to a grandparent and you're there with them to actually give them the cues of what, you know, to help them understand what it is that they're doing. But as the children get older, it was saying that there's really no correlation in between the right amount of time and negative impacts. It is, what are you doing at dinner? What are you reading? How, you know, what is the education level right of the parents? What is the involvement of the parents? It was all these other things right that aren't the boogeyman of the screen the time, the internet.
And that's what I be trying to tell these daggone parents. They want, like I said, they want, to your point, Terrence, they, you know, give me a pill basically to give my kids to not be on social media so much. And I'm like, you're the pill. You are the plug. Like, you set the standard. You set the tone in your house. You create those rules and regulations. I tell them all the time about no phones at dinner. Like, you need to, I always advise parents to create a digital contract that will govern device usage in your home. So work on it with your kids. If it's no devices at dinner, if it's no devices at bedtime, whatever that is, everybody gets to say in what those rules become, and the consequences of breaking those rules also need to be in writing. Everybody signs it. You know what I mean? Go get it notarized if you want to be like super, super official, but It is you, you know, you are the pill, or the silver bullet that's going to make the difference in your kid's life. And for the life of me, there is always pushback. I always get pushback from parents. They think it's harder than that, or they want it to be something else. You know, a switch they can flip that makes it better. And I'm like, it's not, it's you. It is you and your involvement in your kid's life. That's it.
Yeah, I have a really good friend who is a principal, and he was just telling me times when he was a teacher and you're talking to students, and he is in the inner city in Cleveland, Ohio. And it's like, you know, you ask kids, well, I need you to bring a book in. And the only book he's old enough to be my dad. He's actually one of my best friend's dad. But he's like, the books that would come in would be the Bible. Mm-hmm. Or a telephone book, because those are literally the only books that are in the house. So so it's very easy to say, oh, well, these kids spend all their time on the screen. They're not reading and writing. And it's like, well, no, they're spending a lot of time on the screen, but they're not reading and writing because they don't have anything to read or write. There's no one there that is working with them. And I said, this is not, I don't want this to come across like I'm blaming anyone that's low income for doing this. We understand it. Like, sometimes you have no choice but to work two jobs, because if you only work one, you can't afford to live in your home. I get those kind of things. But a big part of this is that the screen time thing is just it's almost like I can't even think of the word. That is not the problem. The problem is that the other things that are also happening, because you are not coming from an affluent childhood. It's like, you know, one of the things is like, make sure that when you are eating dinner, that you don't be on your screen. And it's like, let's make sure that these children actually get to eat dinner. That was one of the things. It's like, you know, I don't know that a lot of people think about this, but there are a lot of children who come home, and, you know, one of the things the schools do now is that they will actually send a box lunch or a box dinner home with the child, because they know that that's the next time they eat will be the next time they come to school. So they are literally sending food with them home to eat. So it's like, so don't have a screen on while you're eating. We have to look at things. Let's make sure that child actually has the opportunity to eat. And then we can worry about screens being turned on.
And that's just one example. You know, it makes sense. It makes sense to where if you're eating dinner together as a family, you're supposed to be eating dinner together as a family, right? Mm-hmm. So common sense would be, all right, well, if you're watching your tablet or you're on your phone, that's taking away from the interaction at the family time during dinner. That doesn't necessarily have to be one of the hard, fast rules. It's just logical. Like, all right, well, since we sit down here and eat family, let's do it together. But I will say, whether they're low income or not, there are some affluent kids and some affluent households to where either the schedule is so busy with the parents and the kids, and kids got their own thing, or the kids get older, they get into activities, they get into work, or whatever the case may be. They ain't even eating dinner together at all anyway. Mm-hmm. So I just want to preface, but people assume that if families are not eating dinner together, then it's automatically the low income, the low educational background families win. As you get older, speaking personally, I've got kids of age that we have to drag them down just to eat dinner together as a family because they're busy doing other things. We readjust mm-hmm. the schedule forward or backward based on who's doing what that day. You know, so I didn't want to give the impression that this article is saying, well, you know, if your kids are not, if your kids are on the tablets at dinner time, then the whole family's ruined. You know, I think the article does a good job of saying that here are some things you can do now that you know, just because the kids have a screen in front of their face, then it's not going to rot their brains. The same thing Rob said about gaming. Same thing he said about rapping.
Well, Kayum put a comment Kayum made a comment. The screen time is a symptom, not the illness. And it's true. It's like mm-hmm. technology on face value is not a problem. I mean, human nature is going to be human nature regardless. You know, through the ends of time, people will do what they want to do. People will be mean. People will be, you know, nice. People will be kind. People will be whatever they're going to be. You know, these mechanisms just maybe make it easier to do and facilitate an easier time for it. But people are going to be people no matter what. But parents, you know, I think at the end of the day, if you think there's a problem, you got to start with yourself, honestly. And again, it might be hard. It might seem impossible, but you got to start with yourself. If you think your kid is having a problem with screen time and they can't seem, they just won't put that phone down. I'm like, you know, you got to start with yourself. Yeah, you got to start with yourself. Honestly, you do. You do. It sucks, but you do. And it might seem like there's no alternative, you know, when you're working two jobs or doing whatever you know, you might be hustling to do, but you got to find that time and make that time.
So Stephanie, just to put a bow on this, because, you know, I've been told this is what you do. This is like one of your life's missions, talking about this kind of stuff. Can you just give parents that might be listening to this a tip or two or three about what they should be doing when it comes to their children's screen time?
Well, number one, you should be monitoring it. Number one, I think parents, especially as with older kids, tend to just hand over a device and then that's it. You never have a conversation about it. You never say, okay, I'm giving you this phone, but you're only going to be able to use it for X, Y, and Z and, you know, or this time or that time. You know what I mean? Like no conversation ever really gets had about how the device use will work in the household. So that's the first thing. You got to have the conversation, you know, whatever that looks like for your household. You got to start with that conversation. Then you got to revisit that conversation because as they get older, things might change. You know, maybe you get an extra hour, you know, whatever. This is what we do if you want to ask for a little bit more time or visit a different website. As it relates to social media, you should be friends with your kids across all platforms. They should not be able to be on a platform without you knowing that they're on that platform and being friends with them on that platform. So that's going to require, you know, a little, maybe pushing some parents out of their comfort zone because everybody's not as tech savvy as we are. So, but this is what you got to do. You know what I mean? If you got to sit down at night when your kids go to bed and get on your laptop and figure out how to make a Snapchat account, then that's what you got to do. You know what I mean? Because you need to understand where these kids are. You need to understand how to dig into those apps and find those privacy settings, find those parental controls, and know how to enable them if they need a passcode or whatever the case might be. You need to understand how to do that to protect your children. The internet is a really, really bad place, and you really need to be able to protect your kids from different types of content and different types of people that they are going to encounter when they go online. So it's work, but it is the work of raising children in this digital age.
I think that's a good place to move on to the next story. So thank you for that.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So this one, I actually texted both of y'all this morning because this report just popped up today. So I hope y'all had the opportunity to go through it, take a look at it. It's a 38 page PDF. So there's a lot there, but the state of Black professionals in tech is a report by InfoTech Research Group. And it's out and it highlights unique experiences of Black employees in the tech industry. So we will actually put a link to the PDF in our show notes. Because I said, this is there's a lot of information here. When I was reading through this, let me just say first that the research was done by two directors of research, Allison Straker and Ubad Farah. And it's based off of an October 21 survey with responses from 633 Black professionals. And as I was saying, as I read this thing,
Rob, uh-huh. Is that enough? 633 people?
They weren't all Black. If you look at the breakdown in their appendix, the number African, of Black people UK, was only like, it was 25% Black and everybody and 75% others. So it was less. So 25% of 633, a quarter of that is what? 200 and some change.
So yeah, that was one of the questions. It's like, there's not a lot of folks who answered this. But then when I started to go through the depth of the questions that they needed to get answers on, there was a lot of stuff that they were asking. So I just don't know that these reports are ever going to have thousands of people on them. That being said, the results of this survey, the state of the Black professionals in tech, I found myself kind of saying, it's like, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I see that. A lot of the stuff, it was kind of like a lot of it is like, yes. And I think I was saying that because, well, that's my experience. I'm not going to talk for you guys, but it's like, yeah, this makes perfect sense.
There were no surprises. I'll put it that way. The thing, my whole thing at this point in the game, in the year of our Lord 2023, it is just willful ignorance at this point, or obstinance or stubbornness or IDGAF-ness of these companies to not have a diverse workforce. Like every single study that has come out about diversity and inclusion has shown and proven that those companies that incorporate this and make sure that their employees are actually engaged make more money. Period. And so the idea that, you know, so I'm thinking now, should we be taking this to the shareholders? Because like the shareholder value is supposed to be the company's, you know, prime directive. And if you are that disinterested in making money because you hate Black people that much, that should be a problem for your shareholders at the end of the day. And so, like, I think that, I don't know. I don't know if that's something that can finally get these people to wake up and take notice when your shareholders finally start saying, yo, you ain't making as much money as you could because your workforce is 80% white. So, you know, get some more Black folk up in there. Like, I don't know what else to do at this point, because y'all just want to make less money at this point. You actually want to make less money.
There's one stat that I wanted to pull out here where it says companies with more diversity achieve more revenue from innovation. So if you are more diverse, you make more money.
You make more money.
And so this is what I do like about this. They are putting hard numbers to this. 45%, you know, innovation by companies with above average scores. 26% in innovation made by companies with below average scores. Now, I'm not a savant, but I do know the difference between 45 and 26 is almost 20%. It's 19%. So just by being more diverse, you generally are going, when it comes to innovation revenue, you're going to make more money in your organization. And there's just stat after stat after stat throughout this report. This tells you like that. It's like, if you are more diverse, you make more money. If you are more diverse, your people tend to like working for you more. And here's the thing. It's not just Black people liking to work for you more. The others like to work for you more as well when you are diverse. I like how they pointed out some of those kind of things as well. So another one here was that, and this is one that you have to take to heart. Only 23% of Black professionals are very satisfied in their current role. You compare that with 34% of all professionals. So you're saying, well, if only a third of your people are very satisfied, that's not great. But you know what's not, you know what is even worse than not great? Only 23%, less than 25% of your Black professionals being very satisfied with their roles. So, and here was one that I think we could spend some time on is microaggressions and racisms are barriers that hinder solutions that support employees. And Black employees say so at much higher clips than their counterparts. So when it comes to microaggressions, 34% of other people claim that microaggressions are problematic. 54% of Black professionals say that this is an issue. 23% of others say that racism is an issue. And here's the thing. This isn't just white folks. This is white folks, Asian folks, Indian folks, Asian, you know, it is everyone else other than Black folks. 23%. Say that there's a problem with racism. 50%, one out of two of Black employees in this survey say there's a problem with racism at the organizations that they're working at. So
I'm gonna let you finish. But when I saw it, I'm glad you brought this particular slide up, because I wanted to tell a quick story about my time in corporate America, because I think, you know, some of our listeners may not be Black and might not be understanding what the big deal is with these particular metrics in, you know, specifically. And, you know, I can remember, you know, I'm not going to necessarily say where I worked, but, Fortune 500 company, the whole nine. And I can remember I hadn't been there that long. And, speaking of sharing offices, there were these two white guys that shit. They had their own, like, we all had cubicles. Everybody had a cubicle, but they shared a office because there just happened to be an actual office space in that the larger office space. There was like a smaller office that had a door, and it was just a bigger space than the cubicle. So they put two people in there. So they shared that office space. And then the wall to the cubicles was right outside their door. So it kind of made a little hallway past their door. And on that wall to the cubicle, the outside of the cubicle, they would put just funny stuff. They would cut stuff out of newspapers, and, you know, it would have been a meme had it been 2023, but back in, you know, 1998 or whatever. That's not what we called it, but they would clip stuff out of papers and little funny stuff. And, you know, so I would, and I was cool with one of the guys. The other guy never really, he just, his energy, his vibe was all off. So I didn't really mess with him, but I was really cool with the other guy because he was super funny. And, you know, so I would, when I would get up to stretch my legs or go get a drink of water or whatever, I would make my way around their, past their office just to see what new was up on the wall that day that I could have a chuckle. And one particular day, it was the day after Biggie got shot and killed. And somebody had cut out a picture of Biggie and then cut out a picture of a machine gun and taped it pointed at his head on the wall. Mm-hmm. And I was like,
this is funny.
Right. I was like, I don't really find that humorous. The death of a black man is funny. Like the fuck. So I wrote a letter because I'm all about documentation. Wrote a nice long letter, and I put it on because I thought it was the guy that I knew that did it. Because like I said, he was funny, and but his sense of humor, I figured maybe he got a little weird with his sense of humor and just kind of took it over the line. I just assumed he was the one that always put all the stuff on the wall because it was usually funny, and he was the funny one of the two of them. And so I went and I just let, I was going to have a conversation with him, but he wasn't there. So I left it on his desk. And when I tell you, when he got back in that office and ran back around to my cubicle, I was like, Steph, it was not me. I knew it wasn't right, but that was the other dude. It wasn't me. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Went back around to the other dude, handed him the letter. And he sits there and, I still trigger to this day. He sits there and, you know, he reads it and he's like, then he does this. Leans back in his chair, head, hands behind his head. And he's looking at me and he, and I'm like, so are you going to take it down? Yeah. You know, I'll take it down eventually. I'm like, so, is there a reason you find the death of a black man amusing?
Worth it. Yeah.
And he goes, I mean, why do you like that kind of music anyway?
That kind of music. Okay.
Sir.
That kind of music.
I said, I had to, ooh, when I tell you, I said, blank, the kind of music I listen to doesn't really have anything to do with why I don't want to see a picture of a black man with a machine gun pointed at his head in a public space in my office place. I said, are you going to take it down? Yeah, I'll take it down. I said, okay, so clearly I need to go to above you, above this. This is above you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's become above all of us at this point. So went to my manager. I was like, please don't make me need to go to HR about this. I need you to handle this today. And it got handled, but that's just one thing that black folks deal with every day.
So, like I said, microaggressions and racism, but I put code switching here is problematic and I bolded it out. And one of the things that we said when we were strategizing what this show was going to be all the way back, when was it? August of, you know, a couple of years back, we said that we were not going to code switch on this show. And I don't think a lot of white America, or just a lot of non-black people in America don't realize that most African Americans speak, we're bilingual. We speak multiple languages. Now, those who are informed know that there's something called African American vernacular English. They have stopped treating like the way we talk like slang and actually look at it more like a dialect because it stems all the way back from the Creole nature of how African Americans that were enslaved were using English and their languages from the islands that they may have been from or from Africa and mixing all that together. And it just has kind of stuck around from the time that we were on plantations through the early 1900s through today. So one of the things, and I've said this before, it's like, you know, you as a child, and there's so many comedians who joke on this, like, yeah, the first time I heard my mama talking on the phone to white people, it was like, who is that in my house that
Harpo, who this woman?
Exactly. where this is coming from. And, you know, in our community, we have a lot of folks who will say, oh, you sound, you know, you talk white, or you must have went to a white school or something like that, because there are just different ways that you speak based off of who you were around in your formative years. But when it comes to a lot, this is not, you know, we are not a monolith. So this is not every African-American's story. But for many of us, we literally walk into the office and have to do this switch to where I'm not going to talk like I talk. I'm going to talk like they talk to make them feel more comfortable in having interactions with me. And the level of mental stress that puts on you to be able to do it, because you know you're doing it, number one. And then two, it's like you faking the front to try to make somebody else feel good.
Man, I used to wear khakis, sweater sets, and kids to work every day. That was like my uniform, yo. And y'all know good and well, I don't need to be in nobody's khakis or nobody's sweater set or nobody's kids.
Look like you came straight from the Gap before LLJ made it look cool.
I stayed up in Eddie Bauer was my store of choice, and LL Bean. My entire wardrobe, my work wardrobe, I make the distinction. My work wardrobe was Eddie Bauer and LL Bean. Everything I had and that I wore to work was from those two stores. And it was just crazy, because you want to fit in. You want to fit in, and you don't want to look different. You don't want them to be, oh my God, look at them. You know, and back then I had hair. So, you know, it was different. Occasionally it would look a little different, and then you had to answer all those questions and all. It was a lot. It was a lot. I'm so glad I don't work for nobody no more.
So is that the answer? Well, not the answer. What are the solutions to this? Now, Rob, I see you put in the article or the report, it put up some different things that you can do. But clearly, going back to what Stephanie said, they don't care.
They don't care at all.
You know, they can,
it's like you got to laugh to keep from crying.
Yeah, they can put out a commercial. You know, they can, you know,
make a donation to the UNCF.
Right. They can show up in Black History Month. You know, mm-hmm. They can say, you know, they can give to HBCUs. But really, what is the solution to this? Like Stephanie mentioned, I'm glad I don't work for nobody no more. Is that the solution? You know, what, you know, we talked about it earlier, to where companies are pushing back on, you know, don't really care if people want to come in the office or not. So if they, right. You know, stopping people, you know, yeah, we don't care if
you don't care about no black folk.
right. Surely they don't care about diversity, you know, equity and inclusion. So what is the solution? Do we shut up and deal with it and cross our fingers and hope that in 2050 it'd be 51% minorities in society as a whole for them to start changing? Or do we venture out on our own? Or what is the ultimate, and I'm asking you, but I'm also asking the people who, you know, put this report together. You know, if we know this is the case, and clearly we know they don't care.
So
what's the next step?
So one of the things, the number one on this chart, because I linked to a graphic out of one of the slides in the PowerPoint, and it shows ratings by black professionals. What's number one? Mentorship and sponsorship. But there's caveats. It's what does that mentorship and what does that sponsorship look like? So I'll just give you a personal epitaph. You know, in my tech history, you know, I actually got pretty high in the company. At one point, I was executive director level, and I had a lot of directors and managers and team leads and actual engineers and stuff that worked up under me. But I was a very specific part of the organization. What I started to notice as I moved up, it didn't matter whether, like I said, I specifically was in sales engineering for most of my, you know, most of my career in IT. That, you know, I've been a sales engineer, ran sales engineering teams, but I would have marketing people coming and talk to me. I would have people on the help desk coming and talk to me. Basically, what it ended up being is that at some point, just about everybody that looked like us that worked in the physical building that I was in, at some point would come across my path because I was the highest African American in not the entire organization, but in the part of the organization that I worked in, you know, in Ohio, basically, you know, where my office was, you know, I was the highest one. So a lot of it was, hey, how, you know, just feeling like you have an ally. And, you know, we have this term and, you know, and I tell people, especially young people who are listening to this, and you'll know what I mean. All skin folk ain't kin folk. So you have to be careful with that. But there is just, hey, okay, I can relax. I can talk like I talk and you're not going to think less of me because I talk like you probably talk when you're not in this office. Can I ask you some questions? How do I do this? How do I do that? That is a big part of it.
But even still with that, that's us making a way out of no way. That ain't the company pushing down. All right. We need to make sure that you have a mentor, somebody that you feel comfortable with.
I still say. I think it needs to move to a shareholder issue.
Yeah, I was going to go back to that as well.
People need to bring it up to the shareholder. I said that earlier. I'm like, shareholders need to understand when their companies are being willfully ignorant and willfully diminishing their earning potential on purpose by not having a diverse workforce. Like they need, shareholders need to know that. And that needs to be on when the next vote comes up at the next quarterly meeting or whatever, they need to know that this company didn't potentially make this much money, more money this earnings call because they will not diversify their workforce. They refuse. We've talked to them. They're at 2.9% today. They were at 2.9% 2 years ago. We wanted to get them to 3.2 and they wouldn't even budge on that little bit. So because they didn't do that, here is the potential money they did not make this quarter for this earnings call and get them shareholders involved and say, are we going to now vote to get the CEO out of here and get somebody in here who will make us more money by diversifying this company or what are we going to do? For that. So I think they're the only people at this point that have any power to move a corporation's hand, and say, listen, I don't care who you got up in there, but if getting your black workforce from 11% to 13% is going to make us more money, we want to make more money, you know? Right. And like, if America's still a capitalist society, you know, that you gotta hit it. You gotta go where the money is. You gotta hit them in the pocket. Got a head in the pocket.
Are we just a capitalist society?
Yes.
Well, I was going to say, because clearly because of this, there are some companies that have rolled the dice and said,
we don't even want to make money. I know, right? Yeah, so what are we? Yeah. So what kind of society does that make us?
It's harder.
It's a good question.
It's a little bit harder for the publicly traded ones to be that way because that stuff is public. When you're private, you know, this is how I roll. If you don't like it, then you can get out of here and sue me.
Well, there's publicly held companies to where people, they're out there to own a lion's share of the stock. And though you could round up a couple of those people on top of the board. You know, and say, look, here's the deal. Like, what's your boy? Always making noise. Carl Icahn, you know, back in the day, you know, he was one of the big shareholders that when, one of the companies he had a majority interest in, I think Apple was one of them back in the day. To where he was like, all right, we need to be doing this. He would be very,
is Warren Buffett still alive?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, to your point, look, y'all ain't making no money because these companies don't want to hire no black people. Like, we got to get some people involved and hit that bottom line, man.
Yeah, right. Dollars and cents.
So
that's the cash rules everything around me.
This is a really interesting report. I hope everybody who's listening to the show, you know, go check our show notes and take a look at this. It is truly interesting.
And I hope they get some money to expand it. They need more data. They need way more data
than this. But like I said, I'm not knocking it because it's like, yeah, this makes sense to me based off of what they have. So I would love to see more of this, because one of the things that we say this on this show all the time, black folks are not a monolith. It's like, we all look alike, but we're not all alike. You know, we all have different thoughts and think different ways. We have different political leanings, all that kind of stuff. When it comes to, you know, black people, you know, in mass. So the more you get, you're probably going to start to see some variance in some of these numbers. But the interesting thing that, you know, that I always, or one of the things that I always say is like, well, how do you make this better? Is that there are reasons why, African Americans and, you know, in our space is technology. So I'll talk about our space, but this is just a kind of across the board. When you are really, really good and you are wanted, your name is out there. People want you to come and work for them because you do really good work and you check a box. But you see a lot of folks who's just like, I didn't leave because I wasn't getting paid. I didn't leave because somebody was just being blatantly racist to me. I left because the culture just didn't match up. I felt uncomfortable being my authentic self. And I don't know how companies ultimately are going to get to that, but they're going to have to, that, you know, they're going to have to. These numbers are, like I said, if you are diverse, you make 20% more in certain areas of your business as compared to not being diverse. That is just a black and white type of thing right there. It's like, you know, do these things, make more money. Don't do these things, make less. And to your point, Stephanie, I think shareholders, if they keep hearing these stories over and over again, that'll help. The other thing too, is that when you really, if you are an organization and you really are trying to work on your diversity, your DEI, actually hire somebody, get a consulting firm, get someone in your organization that does this stuff and has an idea. And before we get off of this, I'll just leave you this one thing. I remember working, you know, at a company, and one of the things they said, you know, we need to get more African Americans in here. So we're going to start going to more job fairs and making sure that we're trying to pull African Americans in at these job fairs. And then you look at the list of schools. Now I'm making this up because I don't want to give any indication on what this university, you know, or what this, you know, company was, but it's like, you go to the University of Vermont and it's like, well, the University of Vermont has 0.8 African Americans to go to school there. How well do you think your program is going to work at that school as compared to going to FAMU, as compared to going to North Carolina A&T, as compared, or even if you want to go to PWIs, as compared to going to Ohio State, where there's just, it's so massive that there's a ton of black people there, or going to Texas to where there's just a ton of black people there, or going to Alabama. Alabama is not a ton. So Alabama State, on the other hand, a ton. So you have to actually look at, where are you doing your recruiting and all that kind of stuff. And like this, you know, we'll leave that for another show.
Yeah, but that pipeline problem.
But it's just pipeline. Too. So. But as I said, this article right here, the state of the black article, this research, the state of the black professionals in tech, is actually a really good long read. So we'll link to it. Go check it out. So y'all, we are to the point in the show where we want to do our spotlight. This is our fourth one in a week. We've done one every week this February for Black History Month. And this one is one that we've done before. So this week we're shining the spotlight once again on Valerie L. Thomas. So she was an inventor who contributed to the development of the Space Physics Analysis Network for research related to Halley's Comet, ozone hole studies, and a supernova, as well as creating the technology to make 3D movies possible. Born in February of 1943 in Maryland, Valerie was fascinated with technology from a very young age, but because scientific subjects were not considered important or suitable for girls at the time, she was not able to express her technological aptitude until enrolling at Morgan State University as one of only two women in her class to study physics. Valerie's aptitude for mathematics and analysis led her to a position at NASA, where she managed the development of NASA's image processing systems for Landsat, the first satellite to send multispectral images to study Earth's resources from outer space. In 1976, she started experimenting with the relationship between an object and its real image relative to the positions from concave mirrors. She thought that if it were possible to present and transmit these types of realistic 3D three-dimensional images. Great improvements could be made in video and even in television in the future. In 1980, she received a patent for her illusion transmitter, which is still being used by NASA today. This is one of the first technologies to make 3D movies possible. And as I said, it's being used today still. Ms. Thomas continued, or I should say Dr. Thomas, continued to work for NASA until her retirement in 1995, serving in such positions as Space Physics Analysis Network Project Manager and the Chief of the Space Science Data Operations Office. She received a number of NASA awards, including the Goddard Space Flight Center Award for Merit and the NASA Equal Opportunity Medal. She continues to mentor young students through the National Technical Association and Science, Mathematics, Aerospace Research and Technology Incorporated and Shades of Blue DMV. So once again, we're shining our spotlight this week on Dr. Valerie L. Thomas. And I said, this is a recap. The first time we did this, I very quickly glossed over the illusion transmitter, but this black woman invented 3D movies. That's basically what she has done. Her technology back in the late 70s and 80s when she got the patent is what allows us to actually go to the movies, put them glasses on and actually watch 3D movies. And it looks like stuff is going to hit us in the face.
Shout out to Dr. Thomas. My annual pilgrimage to Radio City to see the Rockettes would not be the same without her, because there's a part of that show every year. It starts with a video and they hand you glasses when you walk into Radio City, and you know, they play this video and it's Santa, you know, flying all around, blah blah blah. You put the video, you put the glasses on, and you can see presents falling out of his sleigh and birds in the sky and stuff like that. And then, you know, he lands at Radio City, and then like a real live Santa comes out from behind the curtains. It's like, Santa's here, yay! But you know, 3D. Shout out to 3D.
So y'all, it's time for us to wrap up. Before we do, I actually just checked Patreon and we've got a new patron that came in literally right as we're recording the show. This name is cracking me up. Our new patron this week is Captain Ann Tennille.
Nice.
If her name is really Ann Tennille and she is a captain, that is awesome. That is awesome. That is awesome. So for you young folks who don't.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Oh no, there was a group back out in the 70s called Captain and Tennille. When I was a young kid, I remember watching them with like, they would always be on like Donnie and Marie or something like that when I was a kid.
And they were kind of like a Sonny and Cher.
Exactly.
Duo.
But not to that level. But yeah, Captain and Tennille. That is a cool name right there.
Right.
So Tech Life Steph. Why don't you go ahead and tell folks how they can get at you?
You can find me all around the web at Tech Life Stuff.
Holla. And you can find me all over the internet at Brother Tech. That's BROTHATECH.
And I am at Rob Dunwood on all the things. And we are also at The Tech John on all the things. So until we meet again in a week's time, peace.
Peace.